Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio and Stone. This is a very special episode, isn't it?
It most certainly is. You know, we did this. Has it been a whole year? It's been a while since we had the rock stars in here, the small business rock stars. We had so much fun during that conversation, and we knew this was going to be a blast, informative. I just get so energized when you're hanging out with people that are this bright, this passionate, and getting this level of support from the Georgia Department of Economic Development. So we're blessed in a lot of ways, not the least of which is we get to do this instead of go to a job.
Exactly.
All right. So let's tee up Miss Mary Ellen McClanahan first. What's going on in your world and who'd you bring with you and why?
Hey, Stone. Good morning. Or good afternoon, I should say. Mm-hmm. So glad to be back here again. This year, we have this was our fifth annual Georgia Small Business Rockstars event. And we had four outstanding winners this year. And you're going to meet three of them today. One couldn't make it today. But this is an event where we recognize the uniqueness of small business, not so much job creation and investment, but how they approached that next level. And we recognized it in these four winners this year, and we're just so proud of them.
Now, before we get too far into this, Mary Ellen, can we talk a little bit about what constitutes a small business? Like how are you defining, let's define the terms here a little bit.
Right. For the purpose of this program, right. it's under 100 employees, uh-huh. They have to be Georgia-based, mm-hmm. and they will get bonus points if they reached out to their either local economic developer, chamber of commerce, city, county, or a state resource. They'll get bonus points for that.
Now, what percentage of Georgia businesses are fewer than 100? Do you know?
Yes, roughly 97.5%.
Really?
So 98% ish of businesses are under 100, and because of that, they're a small business. Shouldn't we just call them businesses, and then just the 2% we can call them big businesses because they are?
I'm thinking the same thing.
It's kind of crazy, right? Like, why are we kind of putting an adjective in front of them? They're the real business people.
You're absolutely right. And the federal definition is that they're under 500 employees. And that's 99.8% of Georgia's
right.
businesses.
Right. So doesn't that get, like, why are we trying to diminish these people? They're the lifeblood of the economy and a business.
We've got to find a way to take out the word small from right. small business.
Because it doesn't make any sense. They're the business people.
I agree. You're preaching to the choir.
Trying to fix it. So who do you have with you today?
Oh, gracious. We have Shane Gottwalls, who's with Gottwalls Books. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you about Shane. They have applied, of the 5 years, I think they've applied 3 years. Mm-hmm. And they came, every time they came one number under the winning group. And they did it this time. I'm so proud of them.
What pushed him over the edge? Is it the logo shirt? Because that's looking pretty sharp. Our listeners can't see that.
You dress well.
Yes. Yeah. That's nice.
We'll get into those details, sure, for sure. We have David Pope with Strand RX, just a surprise, a company I'd never heard of and didn't know about those services. So I'm so happy for rural Georgia, and I know David will get into that. And then we have Heather Abbott. And Heather, if you'll raise your wrists or so the listeners can see your lovely jewelry. they make, among many things, beautiful leather bags and jewelry out of shotgun shells and bullets. And other things, she will totally explain more.
Let's start with her. I want to hear about these bullets.
That's usually the question there. That's usually it. Yeah, we started our business probably now it's been close to 8 years. My husband actually is the designer, and we were on twin layoffs, and he'd already been playing around with another business idea. He is a serial entrepreneur, I found out after we got married. I always tell girls to ask that question now ahead of time.
Hold the phone here a minute. Yeah. Twin layoffs.
Twin layoffs. So he was laid off and I was laid off, both in the healthcare industry. He was a nurse and I was a pharmaceutical sales rep. And
God love you. I mean, I would think something like that would be either very tough on a marriage or apparently also the kind of thing that can bring two people together and make you that much more resilient. Right. Yeah.
He'd always wanted to own his own business. And, you know, I was always like, no, I'm real comfortable working for somebody else and bringing in that paycheck. I like that. And I like the insurance. And so, you know, when you're faced with that, I was given a severance package. And so my dad and my grandfather had always owned their own businesses. And you hear these things over the years that then one day you realize are true, right? And it's, why don't you invest in yourself? And so that had always been a kind of a family theme. And so we looked at each other one day and said, well, we'll probably never again get a lump sum of money handed to us, right? Yeah. And what are we going to do with it? So you can pay down the house, you can pay off your car, you can go back into these corporate jobs that were so very gracious to us, or you can bet on yourself. And so we chose to bet on ourselves. And here I am sitting at Business Radio in Atlanta, Georgia, having a wonderful conversation with you guys.
Now, when you were having that conversation in your head, could you have made either choice at that point? Like, were you really weighing, look, we can pay off the house? Like how serious were these other choices?
They were very serious. You know, because we both had educated careers that we were in.
And
he was a nurse.
Right.
Right. He could have gone back and been
a nurse somewhere else.
Correct. Exactly. I was in pharmaceutical sales. I loved it. And it gave me a lot of, you know, leadership and guidance for what I'm actually doing now. And so that was always something that you could recycle those skills and go right back into, you know, that career path or another sales and marketing job. So those options were obviously very, you know.
And they're tempting, right?
Correct.
Because a lot of people are very security minded and that seems like the safer bet.
Correct.
Right?
In your
head. Working for someone else seems safer than betting on yourself.
Yes.
But at some point you made a decision as a family to say, you know what? It seems safer, but we're both laid off.
That's right.
So how safe was that?
That's right.
That's the reality of the situation.
Exactly. You know, and it was a tough time. We, you know, actually to buy our first strap of leather that we bought, we pawned the title to one of our vehicles. And where we pawned that title is actually where we opened our first store. And so there always in this story over the past 8 to 10 years has been a circle that's been completed. So you know you're on the right path. But I think in the beginning of those processes for people that are out there listening and thinking about that, or you're going through it now, you're in a tough time, you know, those first moments you always gravitate back to and you go, you know what, we made it through that. So we can make it through what it is we're going through right now. So it's just very, you know, it's encouraging to look back at the difficult times and know that still, you know, you're on the right path.
Right. But there is the uncertainty because the path hasn't really been carved out of the land yet, right? You're kind of making it up as you go along.
That's right. I've said for a long time that being an entrepreneur is like, you're getting shoved into a hole every day. And there's dirt being kicked in your face and you're just trying to grab away, you know, get out.
Right.
And so what Kelly and I did, there wasn't really a rule book for, you know, we started making accessories out of recycled bullets and shotgun shells. And unfortunately there was no book that we could access for that because we were using a recycled material, which is super popular now, but 8-10 years ago, it was not. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times for any business that you start, you know, there's not necessarily a rule book. There may be somebody that's done something similar. So that uncertainty is extremely, you know, a big part of the story. And so, you know, it's very nice to be able to look back now to realize that, hey, we did make the right decision, you know.
Now, what was the first kind of inkling that you were on the right track? The mouse has to get the cheese, right? You have to get the cheese occasionally.
Exactly. So he started making earrings out of bullets and took them to a family Thanksgiving. And we have a large family Thanksgiving. And so, you know, us girls, we like to look cute, right? We don't like to, we don't like to pretend like we compete against each other, but we do. And so my family has a large contingency of females. And so everybody, I was wearing this pair of earrings and everybody thought, oh gosh, what is that? Oh my, look, you know? And so the backstory on that is he came to me and said, I think I can make a pair of earrings out of bullets. And I went, oh, dear God in heaven. Oh, my God. and I'm going to have...
you're thinking, yeah. Oh, you read my mind. Right? I was hoping so that excited. Someone would be coming.
Yes.
That is exactly
my prayers have been answered. I don't like to hunt. I don't like to shoot. I don't like to go outside.
I would like them on my head.
Yes. Right. Oh my God, I'm going to have these. All I could think, we had a friend a couple years prior to that, and he had shotgun shell Christmas lights on his Christmas tree. So all I could think was, I'm going to have these things hanging from my ears, and I can't be judgy because he's in a fragile place. He just lost his job and he wants to be an entrepreneur. And, you know, oh my God, what are we going to do? And so I have to wear these earrings, right? I mean, I have to as this devoted wife. And so, so he always reminds me now, Lee, that any idea that he comes up with, bullet earrings. If I say, I don't like that idea. You know, all three of us are husband wife teams here at the table. And so we have the luxury of working with our partners every day. And I'm sure these guys can attest to the fact that we don't always agree.
Sure.
So when we don't agree now, I get bullet earrings. Bullet earrings. So he started selling these bullet earrings.
Well, that was a good thing. Yeah. That was the first thing that came out.
Yeah. So and it was our first, it was our first product. It's been our best product. It got us into the Bass Pro Shops. It got us into the Grand Ole Opry. It got us into about 5,000 boutiques nationwide. And so, you know, about 400 to 500 products later, you know, here we are. But it was definitely the bullet earring. And he literally went around with them on a little cart, a little cardboard cart, and, you know, took them into these boutiques and said, would you like to buy them? And they would say, yes, but you don't have anything to put them on. And so he would literally just take them and put them on the counter, you know. And so people were very kind, you know, to us, to support us in the beginning. And I think a couple of them were obviously, you know, I feel sorry for you guys, right? And
they still count.
That's right. They do, because that that exposed the customer to the product. And right. So then the customer bought it. And so they didn't care if it wasn't on a proper earring card. And so the product spoke for itself. And so he tells the story of one day getting out at one of these little boutiques with his cardboard peg that had come out of our garage. You know, the thing you hang your tools on in the garage, it has these pegs. So he would stick the earrings in those. And he got out of the back of the car and the door hit the little pegboard. And all of the earrings just go out into the parking lot. And that was, he says that's his defining moment, because he said it was been very easy to quit right there. Because that was probably the second or third time going into somewhere. And
well,
he
you can look at that and go, look, this is the universe sending me a message.
Exactly.
Right? Because
exactly.
The universe sends lots of messages.
Exactly. It's you choose which ones of those you want to
listen to,
right? Exactly. Exactly.
And he said, you know what? The universe is challenging me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pick up all this stuff and I'm going to march myself back in that store and I'm going to give it to them.
That's right. And he did.
And now you're an overnight success, right?
Right. Well, it doesn't feel overnight, but...
But that's how things go.
That is how things go. Yes.
And then so that built upon, you started to get some momentum, and that kind of laid the groundwork for the progress. And you made some choice. I'm sure you had some setbacks along the way that you thought were great ideas that didn't turn out, or great partnerships that didn't turn out that
way. All of the above. You know, somebody told us to go to America's Mart. We'd never heard of America's Mart up here in Atlanta. And so we thought, okay, great. We're going to go to America's
Bunch
Mart.
Bunch of buyers all
right?
in one place.
Yes.
How easy. It's like
it's
the
amazing.
Mall of buyers.
Yes.
Right?
You can't go wrong.
This is a sure thing.
Lee, you can go wrong. We went to the wrong show. We spent all of our money going to the last little bit of the severance package after we'd, you know, done pictures and product development, all this stuff. And we spend the last little bit of money going to America's Mart. Mm-hmm. We went to the wrong show. We lost all of our money.
Another sign of the universe.
Yeah, another sign, right? You would have
testing
thought we'd have
your resilience, right?
The last 2 days of the show, I couldn't even go. I was so physically ill. You know, just
it's just like crickets when you go to the wrong show.
Yes,
it that's what it feels like, right? That everybody's walking by,
correct,
buying from everybody but you.
Yes, we were at the cash and carry show, and we went and had the nicest booth there, and everybody else had church tables with, you know, a plastic cloth on them trying to get rid of their year end season stuff. And so we had no idea that we had gone to the wrong show, and so we come back home completely defeated again. But somehow, you know, you just keep going. And so I think that's the moral of our story is every time there was a turn that we felt was maybe not the best turn for us, you keep going. Mm-hmm. And so we went to the July gift show and won Best Booth Award, sold, you know, just triple what we had lost.
And it's the same building, though, right?
Correct. Same building. Same floor.
Wow. Me? Same floor.
Yes. Different buyer.
Just different time.
Different
time
buyer.
Is everything.
Yes. Yes. And so timing is everything. And so we ended up, you know, winning the best booth, and we won that consecutively for about 5 years there at America's Mart, and really built a clientele of boutique and gift shop owners that really subscribed to the product.
Right. They resonated with it.
Yes.
And then it was game on.
Yes. Yes, it was. And so we have enjoyed a unique business model of making all of our product in-house.
And you're like right with where you are in your location?
Yes, yes.
So what does that look like?
Yes, it looks like, for a long time, it looked like a Michael's Craft Show is what I would always say, tell people. But we made all of our bullet and shotgun shell stuff up until about 3 years ago. And we've outsourced that production now, but now we make all of our leather product in-house. So, you know, I think that's another thing is realizing that if you're not growing, you're dying. Mm-hmm. And so it was always Kelly and I's desire to continue the product development and the product research and what is our consumer looking for. And so that's where part of that, you know, pharmaceutical mm-hmm. training came in, and learning how to read those markets. And everything that we've done up till now has been a stepping stone for something else and for the next idea and the next thing. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing to be able to see, you train folks and they come in, they don't know anything about leather working. They don't know anything about sewing. And we train them, and we make all of our leather product right there, right upstairs at our shop in downtown Thomasville. Mm-hmm. So it's just been a really awesome, awesome journey.
Did you get your title back?
Yes, I did get my title back. I did.
No, yes. I mean, that's why I get up in the yeah. morning to capture these conversations. Yeah. I mean, the woman pawned the title.
Yeah. And then when we go to like, so
that's incredible.
Again,
that's
Kelly's fantastic. Like, oh, you know, I want to open a retail store, because we were just a manufacturer wholesaler. We'd never even thought about retail. Mm-hmm. And so he's, oh, I want to open a retail store. And I'm like, no, I don't want to open a retail. Bullet earrings.
All right. Now you got
it. And I told him, I said, well, we've got to find a store for this rent. This is all I'm comfortable for. So we start going around downtown looking. I'm like, and it's got to be in a certain radius. I only want to be in this area. You know, I'm laying out all these caveats, and there's the store. and I'm standing there, and he looks at me, and he goes, you know, this is where we pawned the title. And I'm like, oh my God, you're right.
The same place?
You're right.
Get out of here.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. And wow. So we started our first retail store there. We were there for about a year, and then we bought a building this past year on the main street in Thomasville, and we're able to make our product on site there. So it's very, you know, it's very interesting when you kind of do go through those times of what is this going to look like? I mean, you just, you
right. So
know.
When you were pawning the car, you're going to, one day we're going to own this whole building.
Right. Never.
No. The guy's like, yeah, sure. Give me the title.
Yeah. Right. Whatever. Just, I need my rent, you know? So, I don't know, but you know, Kelly has always thought that that would be the trajectory. So I think it's important, you know, in that yin and yang to have someone who is the visionary and then the executor. That's how we've been so successful over the years. Mm-hmm. So I'm not the visionary. Surprise. I know everybody's mm-hmm. surprised right now, but I'm the executioner. you know, and my team says that in a negative way sometimes.
But so for those that aren't familiar, that there's a theory of business that believes that there's two players that are run a business, typically the visionary that mm-hmm. maybe sees ahead, and then mm-hmm. the you call it the executioner, some mm-hmm. people call it the integrator, that mm-hmm. are actually kind of doing the work of the mm-hmm. operations of the organization. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's worked for you guys.
That is how it's worked for us, very much so. I say that he's the juggler, and I catch all the balls that are in the air.
So
and
he's so throwing them.
He's throwing them. Catching them. There is no lack of ideas.
Right.
And so, but that is stressful for someone of my, you know, personality
type. It gives
you
something to do.
It definitely gives me something to do, Lee. I am never, ever bored. My board is never empty. And so, you know, that's how it's worked. But in the bad times, in the slow times, there's always that idea that he has said, hey, shelve this, because when we need it, it'll be there.
Right. It's a prioritizing.
That's right.
It's part of your job, right?
That's right. That's right. And the forecasting and the planning. Mm-hmm. And we've realized that, you know, he and I both like to tackle everything at one time. And we don't have children, so our business
is
our
child.
Child.
Right.
And so we've learned that patience is a virtue, and sometimes you can't tackle everything,
right,
you know, at one time. So, but it gives us something to look forward to, and, you know, and we're not done yet. We're excited about where we're headed and so thankful for, you know, Georgia's economic development folks who have been such a great help to us.
How did they help you?
You know, we kind of reached out when we were in a growth phase to our local folks in Thomas County. So our local economic development, Shelley Zorn, we reached out to her. We were looking for a new space to operate our production in. Mm-hmm. And she was super helpful with that. And so we moved into a warehouse for a short period of time until we could figure out what we wanted to do with our purchase of our building. The Downtown Development Authority helped us there as well, kind of leading us and guiding us to our small business development. And so there's been a lot of players that have helped us. You know, I think the one thing as an entrepreneur is sometimes you feel like you can't ask, you know, questions.
Or you think it's only you. You're alone at this journey when there's a lot of help available if you kind of ask.
That's right. And people want to help. People genuinely want to help you. And we're very blessed. I know every community is not like this, but Thomasville is very community-minded. They're very community-oriented.
And they want to keep you there.
That's right.
Right.
They want you to be there. They want you to succeed. And they want to see the community, you know, I guess.
It's flourish because you're helping create jobs. You're helping, you know, the people draw people there now to go to the retail store. I mean, you're a driver of a lot of opportunity for the area.
Well, in downtown, you know, Georgia is not what downtown Georgia used to be.
Sure.
And there's a lot of effort to revitalize that. But we have been lucky to live in a town in downtown Thomasville where that revitalization is somewhere where other communities look to. So Thomasville's always had a real vibrant downtown. And so we're lucky to be a part of that and be a different part of that. You know, mm-hmm. we're a maker. And so there's been a movement in this country for several years, you know, the maker movement.
Sure.
To showcase products that are made here, you know, whether it's locally. Where you can come like you can at my store and touch and feel. We have a custom design studio that you can come up to and design your own product. So we have folks come in probably two or three times a week and they say, hey, can you recreate this bag? You know, it was my granddad's and I want to hang on to it. I don't want to use it, but I want one like it. Or, you know, a doctor comes in and says, well, I've used my bag till I can't use it anymore, but this company doesn't make it anymore. Will you make it for me?
Right.
And so it's just, or, you know, we had a wife come in a couple weeks ago and it was their 1 year anniversary. And so we have a laser engraver and she wanted to have a nice wallet made that she had kind of put together. She had kind of realized what her husband used over the years. And so she was like, you know, while we were dating, he used this and this and this. And, you know, I want to put this kind of wallet together and then I want to laser engrave this nice note for him. And so, you know, just really being able to involve the customer in the product. You know, there's a little bit of that lacking. And so I think the authenticity for what we bring to the table is really an attraction for a certain customer base, you know?
Well, and let's give credit where credit is due. Thomasville is a marvelous place for commerce. I've known that for some time. I drive through, by, and around when I go see my brother in Tallahassee.
Yeah.
But one of the redeeming qualities of Thomasville, it's not a very far drive from Thomasville to Bradley Sausage.
Yes.
Or to Stripling Sausage.
Correct.
Right? So, I mean, that is a big contributor.
The sausage folks keep us in business.
I'm sure you said it at the top of the show, but the name of your enterprise, what's it called?
It's South Life Supply Co. And I just encourage everybody, if you want to take a peek at what we're doing down south in Thomasville, Georgia, our social media handle is at South Life Supply. And then there's a website there. We throw all of our new product up on social media. Sometimes you'll see my dogs that come to work every day, Jaden Haas, and then our, you know, production folks are on there. And, you know, it's a fun place to be. And we're just really blessed to be able to live in such a great state and a great county that lets us do this and lets us be successful at what we're doing.
And we could all use just a little bit of Kelly in our lives, I think.
Right?
I mean, having someone like that who is in there with you in the trenches, supportive, and apparently has a sense of humor, refers to the earrings from time to time. No, that's everything, right?
Exactly. It is. Yeah. It truly is. The team is what makes South Life. And so, you know, one person cannot do it on their own.
Right.
And so we recognize that. We recognize the emphasis that the community has had on us in between that that horrible show and us going to the July show, we had a lot of community support. So we had gone and done what we in Thomasville is called Plantation Wildlife. And we had gotten such great community response off that. They loved the jewelry. They loved everything we were doing. And, you know, then we went and had this horrible show and we come back home and you still get orders from people around town that are like, oh, can you make this? Can you make that? I want this. Put this in my store. And so the community, and we say this all the time, we probably as a company would not have been the success that we currently enjoy if we did not live where we live. Because Thomasville is just a unique community as far as embracing.
Right. If they didn't support you in that rough time, you might have quit.
We would have quit. Right. Yeah, we would have quit. And then over the years, there's been people that, you know, on the outside looking in, they encourage you. You know, our buyers that have bought from us over the years, they don't realize that every time they call and place an order, it's an encouragement to us to keep going.
Right.
Because they don't know what kind of day you're having. That's, you know, right. They don't. And chances are most of the time when that buyer calls that you have a wonderful relationship with and they're talking to you, it's an encouragement. They don't even realize that. So, right. And then actually our team of folks that help build what we have built. I have Courtney May, and she's going to kill me for using her middle name. but she has literally been with us from day one. So she was the face of Lizzie J's, which was our bullet and shotgun shell jewelry company. We had both companies going at the same time. And so 3 years ago, we went through a rebrand and dropped Lizzie J's and said, we're going to stick with South Life. Because no guy, we found this out, this is a secret. No guy wants to wear a belt that has Lizzie J's stamped in it. No.
Who knew?
They would prefer South Life. So we dropped Lizzie J's and we went with South Life. So Courtney was the face of Lizzie J's for years. She did all of our modeling for us and went to Furman University, got a communications degree. And we always said, jokingly, we'll have a place for you, never thinking she'd want to come back and work for us. But now she is our darling communications director. And so everything that you see on social media, she's in charge of all of the photos, all of the content for the website. All of that stuff. She wears a lot of hats. You know, in a small business, I think it's important for those of you out there listening that might want to start your own small business or you're a part of one. Flexibility and being able to wear lots of hats, that's a really big thing.
Those are must-haves.
They're must-haves. Yeah. I mean, you know,
we don't need specialists in the small business.
No, we can't afford that. That's right. That's right. And so when you think about, as Mary Ellen alluded to earlier, small businesses, you know, providing 98% of the jobs in the state and right. in the country. But we employ less than 100 people. So we cannot afford to have specialists. So that flexibility and the actual genuine desire to see a company really move forward and move to the next level, that's what we're looking for when we hire folks, you know, and it's people who have a genuine vested interest in the company doing well. And a lot of times that's hard. You know, Kelly and I have talked over the years, I think the biggest obstacle for us has been people.
That's not the first time we've heard
right?
that.
Yeah. Right? And we always said, we will not let our employees dictate our success. And that is, it's a challenge. It's a constant challenge, you know, but we have a wonderful team right now. We've got the best team we've ever had. But I joke with them and I tell them that I prayed them here, you know, because...
maybe that could be another service you provide other companies.
Yes, yes. Oh, new business started right now. We will pray for you good workers to head your way, you exactly. know. Hey. Well,
can you pray a couple away? Is that part of... Can
yes,
you do that too?
Yes, we can do that as well. Absolutely. You just put your prayer request right here before we leave and we'll take care of that. So, yeah, but it's true. You know, it's true. So the power of people is a real thing. Yeah.
And one more time, the website?
SouthLifeSupplyCo.com. I know it's a mouthful.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, thanks, Lee. Thanks for having us.
So I want to hear from Shane and his Kelly, whose name is probably not Kelly.
It's not. It is Abby.
Abby. All right, Shane, you're with Gottwald's Books.
That's right.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your outfit, mission, purpose. What are you out there doing for folks?
Well, currently we operate 16 locations nationwide, and we have two more in development. And we franchise. We have a chain of 4 stores in Middle Georgia, and then we franchise and teach others how to do it nationwide. So we're just a few weeks from opening up a couple of new stores. And we take all the books in our warehouse, price them up, sort them out. They come to us. We train them at our headquarters, and we go to their location and set the store up from scratch. So they go from I was actually in North Carolina yesterday with a totally empty space, retail space, and pretty soon it's going to be a fully functioning bookstore. But that flash forward all the way back, you know, the quick and dirty version of the story is we started in March of 2007, and for any business, much less
interesting a, timing yeah, there,
very
Shane.
Interesting time. Ill-advised is the phrase that I always use, and I mean, everyone I assume is thinking it anyway. But you know, who the heck is opening up bookstores at any point since Amazon started selling books and Barnes and Noble and Borders started shutting down? But you know, we've seen all of our success through all of these times, through the worst of the economy. Ebook sales really started taking off just a few years ago and really wasn't too far after we opened. And yet we grew and grew through all of the adversity. So, I mean, we haven't had a year since March of 2007 where we have sold less than the year prior at pretty much every location. At worst, we've been kind of stagnant, you know, over a couple of years at a couple of stores, but very unusual for retail, especially in over the last 11 years. So
what makes your bookstore different?
I mean, we're very hands-on, which is, you hear people talk about retail, and it's always kind of lame when they talk about it. it's our customer service experience. You know, it's the relationships we build. Well, I mean, but really that's what makes the difference. I mean, that's what, you know, we're competing against Amazon where you can click and it gets to your house in a day or two. You have to give them a reason. What I always tell our franchisees is you give them a reason to not buy something on the daggum internet. You give them a reason to come in and see you. Because you're that special and you offer something that Amazon cannot give you. And I keep mentioning Amazon just because that is our number one competitor without question. We like being down the street from Barnes & Noble. We like being down the street from Books A Million because we do used and new books. Mm-hmm. So our prices are significantly lower. We offer a trade-in program that's really good, very favorable for customers, but keeps money coming into our register at the same time. And we do college textbook buyback. But also anything that we're not the dusty, musty, hole in the wall kind of bookshop where you got the guy kicked back with his feet up on the desk and smoking a pipe and stroking a cat and reading a Dickens novel, you know, that kind of thing. That's not what we do. You come in and you wonder,
are you a writer too?
Well, you know, I have an English degree. Yeah. So, you know, you come into our stores and you wonder, you don't even think, oh, use bookshop. Great. These prices are going to be wonderful. No, you go in, you pick up a book and say, oh my, why is this half off the retail price? Oh, well, sure enough, it's secondhand, but in wonderful condition. Oh, and this stuff is so good, I'm going to go home, bring my really good stuff, bring it in for some credit, because I'm going to get some of your really good stuff. And the stores are typically small, and if we range anywhere from 1,400 to 8,000 square feet, but the average is right around 2,000 to 2,500 square feet. So it's small enough to where one or two people can run the store and stay hands-on with the customer. We lay the stores out very carefully to where it could be very self-guided, but it could also be very hands-on with the associates. So it's very difficult for a customer to walk in or out without speaking with someone or without being asked, you know, what is it you're looking for? And, you know, books spark conversations. This isn't, I use yogurt shop, you know, or mattress store. I mean, no offense to the folks who are doing that, but there's not the same passion behind it. You know, you can build half-hour conversations with customers based on the product that we're selling in our business. And so it's just very unique. And our employees, the line I always use is, you spend the same amount of time with somebody buying a $2.97 Louis L'Amour novel as you do with the teacher that needs 50 copies of something for her school. And that's our attitude. And that's, I think, what we translate well to everyone who comes in. I think that's the difference.
So now, what are some of the things you're doing in the stores that are bringing people in? Is it just having books there? I mean, is it just a place for discovery where I'm just going to wander around and just kind of find something that catches my eye?
Yeah, that's the battle we always face when talking to folks about, well, you know, how are you making it? You must not make any money. You know, I tell them that I'm a bookstore owner and people look at me with this despair. I mean, you know, they feel sorry for me and wonder, you know, how do I feed my four children and my wife? You know, I mean, how do we make it? But that's the difference between when you hear on the news that all these bookstores are closing, which, by the way, the last 2 or 3 years, the American Bookseller Association is reporting more membership. I mean, greater volume of new stores
opening.
Well,
people are still reading.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. and that's the key. And that's why I tell everybody, they're still reading. And we have more people that come in and say, well, I used to buy online, but I hated this aspect of it. Or I used to read on my Kindle. But I hate reading off that stupid screen, you know, so give me a book any day. And so, but you have to do the business differently. So when you hear about all these stores that are shut down and borders failing, well, there's a reason why 15, 20,000 square foot stores with 20 employees out there at a time selling a $28 hardback book when Amazon's got it for $17.50. Okay, that's going to be tough to maintain.
Well, the math is hard.
The math doesn't work. And, you know, Barnes & Noble has a wonderful operation, but you notice how they diversify. Mm-hmm. But they're selling remaindered product, which is basically overstock books at discounted rates. They do events. They do author. I mean, there's a lot of things that they do to try to make
food.
It. They're doing music. They're doing food. They have to. So for us, what we do is just keep it as simple as we can. But you cannot, like you said, just throw books in a store and say, all right, let's go make some money.
I hope someone shows up.
I hope somebody shows up. So we do community events. We do lots of giveaways. I mean, like just our stores last year gave away 8,000 books. It was every first grader in the three counties that our four corporate stores are in. You have to create that engagement. So we do a lot of social media. You have to think like a big business and not, again, going to sit behind the counter and
but do you target
sip coffee
like,
and read.
Do you go, okay, we're going to just target people with kids? You know,
well,
or
yeah.
Do you say, I'm going to target, you know, seniors?
Well, and that all that comes naturally, honestly. That we don't even have to target because what fits best with our bookstore business is doing events for kids, doing readings. And then doing these like author events and things, which just attracts a certain crowd. So our two key demographics are our mothers with small children and then male and female retirement age. They have the time to read. The mothers with the children are willing to spend the money to buy the books for the kids. And so our events throughout the year, you could say that they're targeted, but it's just a natural fit. I mean, you read to kids, you know, you bring them in, you give them stuff. I mean, that's what we do every summer. We have a summer reading program and, you know, the author events and the different promotions that we do throughout the year are really just, they're geared toward readers. They're geared toward people who love what we do. And we try to keep the main thing, as you hear sometimes say, and you see a lot with a lot of the Christian bookstores, they've become gift shops that happen to sell Christian books. And what we do is we say, we're going to remain a bookstore. We're going to carry some supplemental products, some sidelines and things, but we're going to keep our focus.
How about a bullet bookmarker?
That sounds great.
I actually made one this week for a customer. No lie.
Wow.
No lie.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we're about to start carrying those in 18 locations nationwide. Yeah.
Well, Heather's got a children's book she's working on too.
Awesome. Let's do it. Let's make it happen.
Now, do you are you open to having local authors with their kind of self-published books? Is that a place for them as well?
Sure. Yeah. No, we're very open to that. Each franchise
like community,
location.
Because it's about the community, right? So if that serves a community, then that fits then.
Yeah. We do some great author events. We're scheduling one right now for the corporate stores. Because again, we have four that we own called Gottwalls Books. And then we have 14 franchises called Walls of Books. But they're all encouraged to do these. Every store, just about every store now carries some selection of these local self-published kind of books. But our stores right now are scheduling an event for authors. We'll have seven or eight authors show up one day and just make it an local author day. So you come in, you see these local people who wrote books and most of them are about local stuff. So, oh my goodness, I had no idea that hotel was haunted. You know, here's a book written about it. So let me pick that up, you know, that kind of thing. And it all goes back to that C word, community. That's
now,
what we're all about.
Is that, do you see your business evolving to be the publisher of local people's books because you have so many markets now?
Yeah. And there are options for that. And we've looked at it. It's just another one of those keeping the main thing. It would take a lot of time. But we certainly could do it. And our franchisees each have the autonomy to make those kind of decisions if they wanted to.
So now how do you see it evolving? I mean, the main thing is the main thing. So you're just kind of just going, keep going all in and doubling down in the community and serving the community. And the more ways you can do that, that helps the franchisees become successful.
Yeah. And as somebody already said it about how if your business is flatlining year over year, you're failing. And doing what you just described has kept us rolling and increasing in revenue year over year. And I think that's really it. Just creating a community environment and serving the community because the books are going to keep getting read. People are going to continue to entertain themselves. And, you know, and our job, really, one of our main roles is encouraging children to keep up the reading so that they continue doing it when they're in middle school and high school and then and graduate and they're not idiots, you know, when they go out to the common work field, you know. So we have a responsibility to just keep people literate. But I think people will continue to entertain themselves with books.
And so you see that trend continuing. You see, even though where a lot of maybe younger people are texts, they're text oriented more than word oriented.
Yeah.
Are you still seeing them progress into reading? I know they read, yeah, maybe they're online and they're skimming, but I don't know, are they still reading at the level that maybe the older generations read?
I mean, just if I be really blunt about the business of it, the two main markets that are the demographics, women with children, the woman herself may never read a page of a single novel, but she is going to sure as heck make sure her young children are reading books. The older woman or older man who is retired and they spend their time, they've got the time. So you can only watch so many movies. So, I mean, I just being probably a little too blunt about it, but I just think that that the people we hone in on will always be readers. And I think they'll always be drawn to the book. People, somebody asked me one time, a business consultant before we started franchising, we were sitting in a restaurant and across the street was a Blockbuster Video that had closed down. And he said, because I was asking him, I said, what do you think about us franchising? You know, we got a good thing going. What if we invest this money to franchise nationwide? And he said, what keeps you from becoming a Blockbuster? And my answer was books. You know, this is a medium that's been around for hundreds of years and people love the touch of the page. And there's a passion surrounding a book that does not surround a DVD jewel case, you know, or a CD or a tape or whatever. I think there's a permanence about it that's going to keep us around for a long time.
Now, what was the thought process of the franchising as opposed to just opening up your own stores? As you, that's what you have been doing, right? You didn't just have one store, you had several stores.
Right, yeah. And again, I'll be really blunt. I mean, we're all business people and whoever's listening is, you know, like business stuff too. I mean, really it's just about a large part about money, which sounds very, you know, crass, but plain and simple, we could not open stores fast enough with our fairly limited resources because we're very small. We started with like $15,000. And most of it came from our relatives. I mean, we had nothing. And I mean, it took a number of years to make it any sense of this business. But, you know, we have the, you know, have those, had the vision and had the business set up, but we could not invest fast enough to continue making this great model work nationwide. So you put it in the hands of other people. And plus, it's a very hands-on kind of business. I mean, this is a community business. I keep saying these words over and over again, but it's got to have a personal touch. And I think it's very difficult to have a mom and pop used bookshop, you know, owned by someone four states away. And I think doing it this way, we teach these book lovers the business so that they can focus on their love and their hobby of dealing with books all day long. So that was part of it. And plus, I mean, of course, we get a check up front. I mean, there's a guaranteed payment, I guess. You know, we just look at the business side of things just to be open about it. Unless we get a small royalty every month. I mean, we could certainly make a lot more money doing it ourselves, but we owe a great debt to each of our franchisees. So we're there to keep our stores going. We got a good thing going locally, and then we're here to support them till kingdom come. So,
but the balance of running a book business locally and then running a franchise of book businesses, those are two different businesses.
Correct.
Because one is you're selling books to your community. Mm-hmm. The other is you're helping other people be successful in their community.
That's right.
So you have to be a trainer and you have to have the answers and you have to kind of manage their expectations because they invested a lot of money with you with this dream that you promised them.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you kind of change gears really in your business to serve that market, because that's a different business?
Right. Yeah. So we had our stores up and running. We then did a consulting gig with someone. We had a gentleman with two young girls who was traveling back from Orlando at Disney World, and his wife had just passed away from ovarian cancer. And he saw our billboard, stopped in, found me and said, hey, I want to do this. Will you teach me how? So that got the idea going. Mm-hmm. And so I said, sure. They paid us a fee. We got him a store up and running. But within a couple of years,
but at that point, it wasn't a franchise.
There was no franchise.
It was just like a partnership had some agreement.
That's right. And that's what taught us franchising was the only way that was going to work. Because after a couple of years, he kind of quit following our lead on things. With franchising, we can kind of slap the hand a little bit. Yeah. So
he
had his own ideas. That's exactly right. So we aren't there to control, but we're certainly there to guide. Mm-hmm. And so that is what forced us into the franchise. I mean, it was a very expensive process to go through it,
right?
But we knew we had such a good.
But there's a lot of regulations.
Going.
That's a difference.
Oh yeah,
because franchising is really literally cookie cutter. They're taking your exact thing your exact thing there, and your promises that it's going to work like it is elsewhere.
That's the idea, right? I went from bookseller to franchisor. So I haven't been behind the counter selling a book in quite a while because we now, like you said, it's another business. And so we went from meeting with our first franchisee and training them on the second floor of a coffee shop in downtown Perry, Georgia, to now having a 46,000 square foot warehouse where we have the training center you just described, our offices, and our warehouse storage for the books.
And then is that as rewarding for you to see it out there in the wild, kind mm-hmm. of doing what it was doing locally for you?
Yeah, there, it's rewarding is definitely the word. I mean, it may keep me up late at night more than I thought it would because, you know, like you have this big thing. And sure enough, if I ever had any, you know, we haven't had a big failure rate or anything. I mean, it's actually gone quite well. But, you know, if we were to see them fail, I mean, it's a little more out of my hands. You know, right. There are things that I can do with my local brick and mortar bookshops where I feel like I can
regain control. Well, you can physically go in there.
I can physically go in there and
you're not
pull,
going to Wichita. Collars.
That's right. Exactly. So, and you also have a, just personally with these owners, you have a, you just feel a great debt to them because mm-hmm. they are believed in you so much.
Right.
So I just feel a very deep personal responsibility to them.
So now when you did that and then you started getting, they were becoming a successful, was it happening at the pace you envisioned? Did, like, you know, when they're buying the franchise, that first one out in the wild somewhere. Mm. And you, you know, it's uncharted territory. Yeah. You're making assumptions it's going to work in a similar manner in their market as yours.
Right.
I know you're rooting for them every day. Like, hey, are you making it? Are you making it? At some point, they start making it. Was that time period faster or slower than you anticipated?
Yeah, honestly, it was a little bit slower. But in some, for some, so like we have people who call us and say, "I'm retired and I want to open up a store because this is something I love to do. My market's a little thin." But I just want to spend, you know, the next 15 years until I really retire, you know, and go stay home or something, doing something I really love. And so the quote unquote success for them is a lot different than the guy that we get that says, "Listen, I want to get three or four of these open,
right? I want
and,
to make, you
know,
and I want to be,
$100,000 a year, you know, within, you know, a couple of years from now." That's a whole different thing. And so it's not about just looking at the bottom line. It's about having these one-on-one relationships with each one, figuring out what it is they want for their family, for themselves personally, and just for the business. It's varied. I mean, some have been a lot more aggressive than I expected. Some have been a little bit slower. Some have got a kick in the pants a little bit more often than others. And others we say, hold up, you know, slow it down a little bit.
What about the profile? Were you able to really get your handle around who this person is that should be running the store?
That's probably been the toughest part of it. Fortunately, we have not made, I don't think, any real grave errors with the people that we select. Because it's not just a matter of somebody has a $80,000 check to open up a bookstore and we say, okay, good, let's get this going. We vet and we talk and we meet and it's a pretty deep process.
But in your head, you were saying, okay, they got to love books. Like you have certain criteria, right? They have to, you know, you want them to be owner-operator. This isn't something you want them to own five and they're sitting back at the beach and they're just calling some teenager that's running it?
Yeah, we'll do it with the right management in place. So we do have some that are sort of outside investors. It just depends on who it is that's running the store day to day.
So was that a tough call too?
Yeah. Fortunately, there's been a couple that were very, very difficult to deal with that it never panned out.
That's self-selected
out. That's right. And I think that's part of it. I think I probably make it more difficult for those people who are going to clearly make it difficult. So when they're pushing buttons after the first conversation with you about
during
all your rules and
restrictions. During,
you know, during the honeymoon period.
you got a problem.
We got a problem. So
all right. I want to hear about your spouse. Because yeah. I think you were saying earlier that everybody has a husband and wife team in this, yeah. in this room. Tell us about that relationship. And yeah, how is that? Fly at home.
Yeah, well, it's it flies. Her name's Abby, and we met at Mercer University in Macon. I got an English degree. She got a business degree. And sure enough, we had an opportunity to open up a business right after we got married, and it was just good timing. Again, no money. We had a $15,000 and a 1,500 square foot store with 10,000 books, and you know now we're, I don't know how many times and that.
Who
times
held
that.
Your title?
Well, she... we both had, you know, quite a, it was just a very odd story, but coming together, it just ended up working and she ran things. She was the CEO. She was the COO. She made it work. But then once it really became a business, that's when I stepped in and then it started rolling. So I guess, you know, going back to what you were talking about, just the ball juggler. I mean, that was probably more her at the beginning. And then I started catching them and then making it work. So
now how did the Georgia Economic Development folks help?
Yeah, we a lot of it came later, but and just not realizing what is out there. from the various development authorities. So, you know, later on, it was the number one way. I mean, there were many ways that they helped, but later on, it was with the Peach County Development Authority when we bought our warehouse. I mean, we had never invested in a 46,000 square foot warehouse with 25 acres around it, right off I-75.
You don't do that every day.
Right? Yeah, we didn't do that every day. Yeah. And they were instrumental, the Peach County Development Authority, in helping us out with that.
Now, what was the impetus to keep trying to do this small business rockstar program?
I just felt like it was too cool of a story. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. I mean, we're in the middle of it. We don't feel like it's this great big thing, but I mean, it when you, bookstore, multi-state, based out of Middle Georgia. I mean, golly, what, you know, we didn't have a lot of money behind us. You know, we weren't corporately sponsored or anything. I just thought it was a really neat account. And we applied those couple of times, and sure enough, found out there's, you know, a couple of judges that I guess didn't like us or something. But this year they saw the light. And,
we always got free samples. You didn't give me
any. I should have shipped you some books.
Good stuff. So if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Gottwallsbooks.com. It's GOTTWALSbooks.com or wallsofbooks.net.
Fantastic. Well, keep up the good work, man. And congratulations. Well, and I mean, I love to see the persistence. I mean, you stuck with it.
Oh, it was tough. Yeah. The first day we had total sales in one store of $4. The day I said, oh man, we got to make some changes. And that was the turning point. And, but we saw a whole lot more than that right now. So.
All right. Well, Mary Ellen, you want to introduce our headliner? He has been sitting there so patiently. Should we call him the headliner? I mean, he should get that for having sat there a while.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
All right. Tell us about David.
David Pope with Strand RX. It's formerly the Creative Pharmacist, which captured...
Wait a minute. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. That's a...
Can be taken there, a lot of ways.
Don't go there. No. But again, you're right. It caught our attention, of course. But then the way he wrote his story and how he can help rural Georgia, and I'd rather have him tell the story, but it just captured our rural hearts.
All right, Dave. You're up. Good.
Well, first of all, gosh, I think we could just end the program now after hearing the passion, you know, that
tough acts to follow.
These are tough acts to follow.
I'm sorry about that, Dave.
I agree. I can't do anything with bullets or anything like that. So we are a clinical technology that engages the community pharmacist, who many times is in the rural, suburban, or urban space, to be able to affect patients living with a chronic disease, such as diabetes, heart attack, heart failure, high blood pressure, all of those things. And so it really is a perfect marriage that we have, where we're, in one respect, we are empowering the pharmacist with the right tools at the right time, with the right purpose, technology-wise. But we marry them up with a patient living with a chronic disease. And in fact, it's actually 87% of all of healthcare spend, as we hear so much on the radio and television now about, all of us saying, you know, what can we do about healthcare? Everything, something has got to change. Well, we're just using the power of the community pharmacist to be able to do that. And so in order to do that, we've developed an edge-to-edge solution where we guide pharmacists to be able to engage a patient living with a chronic disease. Take diabetes, for example. Again, one out of every three United States adults now has either pre-diabetes or diabetes. And so again, the results are staggering.
Yeah.
And so again,
some of us out there in the rural areas too, Mary Ellen, we eat a lot of fat back and cornbread.
That
probably don't help much.
That's right. Agreed. We were talking sausage just a little while ago, right? I don't know that it's helping us too much. And so again, for diabetes, we empower that pharmacist with educational tools to be able to connect with that patient, to teach them the rudiments of diet, of exercise, of utilizing medications, and really in that order to be able to do that. So we actually develop all that educational material for them. And then it's time to document. And so again, one of the things that we saw is that pharmacists were seeing their patients over 20 times a year. They were only seeing their a physician many times, only about 3 or 4 times a year. And that's that chronic care patient.
Yeah.
So we leverage that time to be able to engage them. We document all of those things that the patient is talking about and doing with the pharmacist. And then we were the first in the country to be able to connect that data that the pharmacist is gathering and communicate that directly to the electronic health record of the physician. So again, we're in the rural space. That patient has diabetes. There's not a whole lot of healthcare in the space, but we have the pharmacist in that regards. And so they're engaging with them, they're talking with them, they're counseling them, they're becoming their health coach. But at the same time, every moment of that is being disseminated back to the physician so that they can be a part of the healthcare team as well. So we're not as siloed as we used to be. And then again, so we're in all 50 states now. We work with a community pharmacist. Now, those would be called independents. They are businesses of their own. Dare I say small businesses, but they are, many times the lifeblood of that town and that community. May not even be a red light.
Now, what was the thought process to use the pharmacist as kind of the point person in this equation where typically most people are going through that physician?
So I'm a pharmacist myself and has still practice, albeit on the weekends and holidays these days, just to keep my skills sharp. But I serve on a lower socioeconomic side of the town, right? And I wouldn't have it any other way because I realized very quickly that healthcare is needed in so many different spaces in that regard. And so I personally became a diabetes educator, began to engage and speak with and counsel patients with high blood pressure, with chronic disease of many kinds, and then realized that, again, not only was it a smart business decision to be able to do that, but we were affecting care in many ways. And so you have these patients who, again, if you look at...
Is it because the pharmacist is more approachable?
Yeah, they're available, number one. Again, right. You could walk in right now and see any pharmacist that you wanted to, again, within a couple minutes wait. But at the same time, they're actually, for the past 2 decades, every one of them has come out with a doctorate degree. And so sometimes underutilized in that regard. So we're just leveraging the power of them.
Now, what about the consolidation of all of the Walgreens, CVSs all kind of coming together? How does that impact this?
You know, they've actually been impacted just as much, many times as the independent pharmacist has as well. In fact, just got through meeting with several of them who are saying, look, we've got to make a different change because, again, medications and being paid off, you know, making a living off of medications alone is changing. Again, those reimbursements have decreased to the point where pharmacists have to make a change. And I don't know that they're going to pay us more in the coming days, but I bet they'll pay us differently. And so what we've done is that we went to payers, insurers, all right, so the Humanas of the world out there. And we said, you've been looking at your pharmacists as the purveyors of medicine for a long time. They're the ones who give you your medicine whenever you need it. And you probably just have a certain number of pharmacies, whatever it may be. But what if I told you that they could actually improve the cost of care? They actually improve outcomes. And so that patient wouldn't go to the ER as much. And that patient wouldn't have to use so much of the healthcare system so much. So we're driving not only through the medication side, but even just through the counseling side. And so therefore, insurers agreed. And they said, yeah, I think I'm willing to do this. It's a feel-good story. It's a win-win on every side.
We're talking about millions of dollars here. These are big dollars that you're helping them recover or save or whatever the right word is.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So the average diabetes patient, for example, will spend between $8,000 and $25,000 per year. And you've got one out of every three either already having diabetes or headed in that direction very quickly unless someone or something intervenes.
Now, could this have happened prior to the kind of the new attention that's being placed on outcomes as opposed to just care?
Well, that's a good point. Certainly that was a driver of that because there was the head of the Health and Human Services Division of the government came out and said, you know what, by 2018, we want 90% of all that the federal government pays for, we want that to be based off of quality. I don't care if it's a knee replacement or a crutch or a medication, we're going to pay on quality alone. And that certainly drove that quality measures and doing all those things. So that's part of what we do as well, is to be able to make that pharmacist organizationally ready to make that impact. Then we take that data because we're their documentation system and we can actually show the clinical impact that the pharmacist has on those patients. And that's not only matters to those payers or those insurance companies, but even to to the prescribers, to the physicians in the area, saying, you know, this is the pharmacist isn't just there to call me whenever I wrote something wrong, right?
Right.
They're wanting to say, well, as a matter of fact, I want to send, and I choose to send my asthmatic patient to this pharmacy because I know that they're going to be a partner with me to improve their health.
Now, are you finding that, because it sounds like maybe this is different in smaller areas than it is in larger cities, but now this pharmacist is wearing a little different hat, and maybe now they have a little different responsibility and they have a little different view of themselves and their service. Because at some point, some of them might have thought of themselves, I just am counting pills and putting them in a bottle. I don't even interact with a human being. A lot of times I'm just seeing a sheet of paper and I'm just filling it. But now you're requiring of them almost this kind of, I have to get to know this person so I can tell them or share with them what's the best thing they can be doing. Mm-hmm. So it's great, but it probably goes back to, I would imagine, why they got in the business for the first in the first place.
You're right. None of them went to pharmacy school saying, I want to make a lot of money.
Behind the counter and never talk to a human being.
Count by fives, you know?
Right?
They're saying, I want to help people. I want to engage my, right? my community and help my community live a better, a healthier life. And so there certainly is a big movement right now within pharmacy practice to say, you know what? We're not just the purveyors of medicine anymore. I love the old Seinfeld, you know, where it says, I'm taking these pills from this big bottle and put them in, little this bottle. Littler bottle. Right. I can't be down there and talk to you people. So the pharmacist is now saying, look, I am arm in arm, locking arms with you going down this path. You were just diagnosed with COPD, with asthma. You're just trying to lose weight, whatever it may be. I am here to partner with you. I'm available and I have the skills and the knowledge to do so. I'm going to work with your physician. I'm not going to take the place of your physician.
Right.
I'm going to be the strong offensive coordinator to do so. So those pharmacists are at one point are now saying they're, I'm willing, and we just help to make them able.
And then I would think that it's also good job security for them, because if it's just counting pills, there's going to be a machine that's going to just count all the pills, right?
You're right. Even Amazon, as was mentioned earlier, is looking into the space as well. It looks like they'll be entering into that at some point.
Of course they are.
Well, that's right. You know,
name anything under the sun.
Yeah, no
right?
kidding.
Well, the bottom line for Amazon, the guy said it many times, is your margin is my opportunity. So... You know, if there's a less expensive way to do something, they're going to figure out the technology behind making that happen.
That's right. But the incredible thing is that we have, again, we're never going to leave this idea of the pharmacist being able to give you those medications. But in addition to that, we've been successful so far in being able to leverage both local, state, even federal opportunities to be able to say, let's give these pharmacists a different view. Let's even have the patient come in and make an appointment with the pharmacist. Because, you know, if you have heart failure, for example, you have a 50% chance of dying in the next 5 years. And yet, as a pharmacist, I say, come in at any point in time, get any prescription you want to. It's kind of up to you. And again, so we now make an appointment with that pharmacist, with that patient as well. We bring them in, we educate them, we are performing specific interventions, working alongside the physician. The technology of just communication and collaboration has been key.
Okay, yeah, because so far this sounds like a marvelous TED talk. Like, this would be a great idea. Why can't we all get along? And wouldn't this be a marvelous way? I want to hear about the execution of this. Yes. Like, the first couple of times you tried to have this conversation with anybody in this ecosystem, did they look at you like you were absolutely bananas?
You know, you put on a great smile. Yeah, you be passionate about what you do. Again, I think everyone here is just so passionate about what you do. You're going to get an audience, right? But again, it's this utopia, right? That says, you know, the pharmacist is in this for the right reasons. And again, we have a willing a group of patients. In fact, it just so happens to be a large number of patients in the country now that have a chronic disease. And no one knows how to figure this out, right? Everybody's got a different answer for it. But at the end of the day, chronic disease continues to rise. And why is that? Much of that is because of the rural space. We just can't reach them very well. So the large corporations of the world, the Kaiser Permanentes and all these others, really have a difficult time reaching there. And so it was just when you can show and help those interested people in realizing that there is a community pharmacist right there. There may only be, you know, a red light, maybe a Subway restaurant and a church, right? But you're almost always going to have that pharmacy there that you can leverage in that regards. And so we've been working, for example, in the state of Georgia with this new initiative called the Diabetes Prevention Program, where, again, we are empowering pharmacists to be able to engage in essentially it's weight loss to be able to improve diabetes. We're working with them on diabetes programs, on smoking cessation with the Center for Disease Control now to help curb smoking and tobacco use across the country. Again, it's been a, I've been pleasantly surprised in seeing not only the willingness of the pharmacist to do things differently, but even on the payer side, and even with the federal government and all these others that are really beginning to say, you know what, I get it.
Well, it seems like you're maximizing an underutilized resource. You have a very educated person in the community who's almost kind of separated themselves, and you're trying to kind of bring them back into the community to deal with the people in a more robust manner.
Agreed. And you know, it also includes the patient as well. Again, we've got to begin to change some thought processes as well. Again, many people have only had the experience of a pharmacist of saying, well, you know, I know that they give me my medicine, and as soon as they can come through mail order, right. Might as well.
See that. Right.
That's right. Yeah. It's not really, they were just, they had a 16-year-old down front saying, do you have any questions for the pharmacist who really looks disinterested in talking?
And they're hoping you say no.
That's right. To where now all of that has changed, where they're saying, not only do we not want you to do mail order, we not only want you to do a 90-day supply, the payer or the insurance wants you to come in and meet with the pharmacist every 30 days. And so
it's like a check-in.
It is. It's exactly
right. It's like how you would with a personal trainer or something where you're having a conversation. They're holding you accountable a little bit just by showing up.
That's exactly right. And it's utilizing the power of the physician and their guidance and goals for you, patient-centered goal.
But now you have a team. It's like you have a healthcare team now that the pharmacist might be the one you're seeing more often now than the doctor.
That's exactly right. And much of that had to leverage, we had to get the technology in place to do that. And so we were the first in the country to be able to kind of marry up the clinical data, which many times the pharmacist never asked you clinical things. They never took your blood pressure, your blood sugar, all of those things. And we can take that and send that to the rest of the healthcare team. In fact, had the cool opportunity not too long ago to be able to go in front of the U.S. Senate, one of their subcommittees, to be able to explain how we're killing the fax machine.
About time.
But no, you had to navigate the bureaucracy of all the compliance and regulation to let this information travel back and forth between these practitioners, right?
That's exactly right. And again, so this was our business strand was started between myself and my old college roommate from the University of Georgia, Dan Lawson. And again, he's a technology arm of what we do. And again, I'm more on the clinical side, but we bootstrapped the whole thing. Again, whenever you get into technology, you just never, you know, again, that can be millions and millions of dollars just on the R&D side, let alone the execution side. And so we did everything we could to be able to develop educational programs first so that it would fuel our efforts to be able to get to the technology side. And so working with various partners, understanding this space again, and that's really where the power of the Georgia Economic Development Authority has assisted us, even all the way with the Columbia County specifically. We're based out of Augusta, Georgia.
Yeah, you pawned your golf bag, right?
That's right. I caddied.
Stay off the ground.
That's exactly right. I will say every major conversation I've ever had with a payer ends with, so can you get me on the course? To which I say, maybe about 4 p.m., we can capture some tickets of some poor soul coming out of the gates, and we'll ask them for their tickets as we go in together.
So now, what's next for you?
So,
what do you need more of?
Great question. Again, as we've bootstrapped everything to this point, we're in a total growth mode because we now not only have the selective audience of the community pharmacist, but now we have chain pharmacy, we have payers like an insurance companies, we have everyone invested in healthcare is now interested in connecting and engaging with the pharmacist. And so again, we spend a lot of our time engaging all of those people. So again, I think about, like, for example, what we're doing in Pennsylvania, where we have a strategic partnership with one of their payers. We receive data from them. We then reveal that data to pharmacists and say, here's patients that are coming to your pharmacy that we want you to meet with every single month and manage their care and be a part of that ecosystem, develop the ecosystem. And the payer is willing to pay you for that, knowing that it's about a 5-to-1 return on investment. And so just in that process alone, you mentioned how, you know, what do we need more of? Well, that means that we need more technology teams. We need more account teams. We need others to be able to tell the story. We have pharmacists who say, I'm willing, but you have to make me able. So just on the pharmacy side alone, so much has to happen. But again, what I've been so encouraged about and blessed with is just the opportunity to work with such an incredible team. We're able to do a lot with what we have.
And so you're getting a lot of positive feedback from all the constituents, though.
We are. So as a, you know, from a patient perspective, again, we're getting rave reviews of this.
Right. The patient probably appreciates more people caring about them. So there's no mm-hmm. negative in that. The pharmacy is probably appreciating because another revenue stream, and they get to serve people, you know, human to human, as opposed to not doing it that way. And then the payers are getting better outcomes because their people are more compliant and they're sticking with it. And they're actually mm-hmm. taking the medicine probably more than they were if you were just handing them and hoping.
That's exactly right. And so it's a win-win on every single side again. And again, it's developing it also within that passionate area of the community pharmacist, again, who says, you know, again, I went to school to help people. And so it's really hitting on that initial first love that they had right. that brought them to that industry in the first place.
And because they've been, I'm sure, cynical over the years where mm-hmm. it seems like all they're doing is just having more hassles or regulation and I'm not really, mm-hmm. I'm not winning. And here you're giving them a chance to win.
It does prescribe a little bit of hope in that regards, because again, as I graduated in 2004 from the University of Georgia College of Pharmacy, and I've never once seen insurance say, you know what, we're going to pay you more this right. year for that prescription.
High fives.
Great job.
It doesn't happen.
That's right.
So now, if somebody wants to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
So we certainly have a website. That's strandrx.com. So again, whether you're a payer, an insurance company in the area, or a self-insured company, and you're looking to engage pharmacists in some way, or if you're a pharmacist yourself, we certainly can, we'd love to be able to speak with you at strandrx.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you.
All right, Mary Ellen, what do you think?
Rock stars, right?
The rock stars, every one of them.
And there's one more who could not show up.
Oh,
today.
Let's trash him or her. Take a minute and do that.
I can't.
No, we'll
I can't
say nice
trash.
Things. No, tell us about them.
Real quick. Akesogen, they're out of Gwinnett County, and they are...
The one that's the closest.
Of course. Isn't that always the way, right?
Oh, heavens.
She drove 4 hours away to get here.
Exactly.
Right? And we'll get them in the studio.
Oh, well, that'd be wonderful.
But we're going to talk. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. They are expert in the field of genomics, providing premier research services and highest quality data for scientists across the world. And they employ about 24 folks. They've recently built 3 new state-of-the-art path labs. They are a Georgia Bio Deal of the Year Award winner, a 2-time Inc. 500 Award recipient, and for 3 years running, named the fastest growing healthcare company by revenue in the U.S. So sorry they couldn't be here today, but I know they would have, you would have been so entertained by their story as well.
Well, if they will send me their pawn story, and I, then we'll
or
see about
book.
It. Or a book, or some drugs, or bullets. Then, we'll see about getting them in the studio for another exciting edition of Bullets, Books, and Better Health.
There we go.
That's right.
Here on the network.
All right. So, Mary Ellen, if somebody wanted to learn more about the different services of economic development, can you share some coordinates for them?
Sure. Our website is georgia.org/smallbusiness. And if they want to learn more about the rock stars, they can certainly apply themselves for next year. The applications open August 1. Mm-hmm. That website is georgia.org/rockstars.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for putting this episode together. It was great to have all these people in the studio.
Thank you.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.